യോഗേന ചിത്തസ്യ പദേന വാചാം മലം ശരീരസ്യ ച വൈദികേന യോപാകരോത്തം പ്രവരം മുനീനാം പതഞ്ജലിം പ്രാഞ്ജലിരാനതോസ്മി സ്തുവേ പതഞ്ജലിം വ്യാസം ശങ്കരം ച മുനിത്രയം കർത്തൃസൂത്രസ്യ ഭാഷ്യസ്യ ക്രമാദ് വിവരണസ്യ ച. We were discussing the 26th sutra of Samadhipada in the last session. The sutra is Sapurvesham api guruhu kalena anavachedat. So, saha purvesham api guruhu, that Ishvara, we should remember that the word Ishvara in Sanskrit means God, but in this particular context, in the context of yoga philosophy, it is not the creator God that we normally understand in the monotheistic religions, but rather it is the repository of the highest knowledge, who is not bound by time, space or causation. So that's why it is said kalena anavachedat, that God and His glory, His knowledge is not limited by time. This is the understanding of the word God in yoga tradition. We already discussed this earlier. Now, there are two important principles to be understood in this particular context. Why the word anavachedha is used? It means unlimited. So, all human beings, highly advanced spiritual seekers, devotees, spiritually enlightened philosophers, sages, saints of all traditions, they too have knowledge, but their knowledge is not kalena anavachedha, means it is not unlimited by time, rather it is limited by time. So there is a limit to their knowledge. They cannot be called the repository of the highest knowledge. Remember, this is the yoga view. We must always remember that the yoga philosophy should be understood, and some of the teachings of yoga, especially the metaphysical aspects of yoga philosophy, should be taken with a pinch of salt. So that is an important point, remember. Yoga and Sankhya, metaphysically, is an incomplete system, both of them. But yoga philosophy had a great relevance in spiritual psychology because it is a yoga system that analyzes different aspects of human mind in its journey to the highest spiritual truth. But the metaphysical conclusions of yoga are not accepted and not acceptable to Vedanta philosophy. That's why many modern thinkers, beginning with Vivekananda, have clearly emphasized the fact that yoga automatically should take us to Vedanta. Philosophically, yoga and Sankhya, both are interrelated, are dualistic systems. They do not propound the reality of an omnipresent, all-pervading, immanent, transcendental reality like Atman, which is present in all of us. It is not an Advaitic system, it is a Dvaita system, it is a dualistic system. So when the yoga and Sankhya philosophers talk about God, it should be taken with a pinch of salt. Not a pinch, a huge quantity of salt. Especially the conclusions of yoga and Sankhya. So that should be kept in mind. The one important purpose of giving classes on Yoga Sutras is, it gives you very deep insight into spiritual psychology, the working of the human mind. And all these ideas are accepted by Vedantins also. That's an important point, remember. The psychology of yoga is accepted by Vedantins, but not the metaphysics of yoga. not the ontology or the metaphysics of yoga, not accepted by Vedantins. The conclusions of the highest reality as found in the yoga system, their view of God is not accepted. But still, it has got a great significance. But so, according to yoga, God is the ultimate supreme teacher. That is perfectly logical. In Vedanta also, the all-pervading supreme reality is a great teacher. So, saha purvesham api guruhu kalena anavacheda. So here are two important points, remember, from a logical point of view. One is the ordinary spiritual seekers whose knowledge is limited, and the very fact that their knowledge is limited, from that we can infer through this tool of inference, is one of the epistemological tools, you know, theory of knowledge. We can infer the possibility of something or somebody whose knowledge is unlimited. The word limited implies a remote possibility of something which is not limited. That's an understanding. Secondly, yoga philosophers also accept a place for a teacher. Now, one point, remember, in Vedanta and also in yoga, we practice spiritual sadhanas, we do spiritual practices, like, you know, unselfish activities, doing everything in the name of Supreme God, and practicing purity, internal and external, meditation, all these we practice. And as a result of these practices, we realize our true nature. So it is a kind of self-discovery. It is not a gift from God, as in the Lutheran philosophy, and it is not predetermined as in Calvinism. Rather, we make our effort. We do our own spiritual practices. And then, through this practice, we manifest our inherent divinity within, present in all of us. Now the question arises, what's the role of a God here? See, a God is mentioned here. Saha means Ishvara. Remember, he, that's the meaning here. He refers to Ishvara. So when you read this 26th verse, you should refer to the 25th and 24th. In the 24th verse, it is mentioned, Ishvara is defined here. Klesha karma vipaka seihi aparamrishtaka purusha visheshaka Ishvara is mentioned here. Ishvara or God is a special type of advanced spiritual soul who is not touched or affected by klesha karma and whose knowledge is unlimited. And in the 25th verse, that Ishvara, his knowledge is infinite. In the 26th verse, again, that Ishvara, that God, is the guru, the teacher of all teachers. Now, what's the role of teacher? Here the question arises. As I mentioned earlier, we have to practice meditation, yama, niyama, all these pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, and all these we have to practice, then only we reach samadhi, as you mentioned, Ashtanga Yoga. Or in Vedanta, we should practice unselfish activities, prayer, meditation, then we manifest the divinity that is already present, inherent in all of us. So this is a human effort. So what's the place of this Ishvara? The point is, Ishvara, through our own spiritual practices, we reach a point of fitness, or we become grace worthy. We reach a point where we will be able to make use of the grace of this God. So there is a synthesis or harmony of human effort and God's grace. God's grace, he means the grace of this great repository of knowledge. So those who do their own spiritual practices reach a point of spiritual fitness, that means attaining grace worthiness, and then they naturally get the blessings of this Ishvara. So that's what I discussed. I can just briefly refer to one interesting episode which I repeated earlier on earlier occasions. A lamp can be lighted only from another lamp. The wick should be brought into close proximity with another burning lamp. Then only the light will be transmitted from one to the other. So we need an external instrument, some agency. Then only the reality within us will manifest. The example is in the Chandogya Upanishad, there is a story which is a very famous story. It is given in the 6th chapter of Chandogya Upanishad. In the 14th Brahmanam, it is called Gandhara Purusha Drishtantaka. An example of how a man who was abandoned in a thick forest was saved by another traveler who was taking the same road. The story is this. A person, let us say spiritual seeker in this context, was traveling from one place to another place, and he had to pass through a thick forest, a narrow road surrounded by thick forest and trees. And it so happened that he was ambushed. He was robbed, and all his possessions taken away by some robbers, who dragged him into the thick forest, blindfolded, and tied him to a tree, and they went away, these robbers. Now, this man who was abandoned in a thick forest, if he considers, oh, this is a very wonderful state of affairs. My eyes are blindfolded, hands and feet tied, all the possessions taken away. Maybe the robbers must have given him a few blows also. Now, if he thinks this is a very wonderful, blissful, satisfactory state of affairs, he will never get freedom from that condition. So he should make a lot of noise. Then another traveler taking the same road will hear his voices, cries, and will come to the thick forest, will remove the ropes, untie him, remove the blindfold, and bring him to the main road, and will show him, see, now you are free, you can take this road, you can reach your destination. So he has to make some noise. Then the other traveler listens to these cries and noises, and out of compassion for a fellow human beings, that person enters the thick forest and, of course, liberates him from that state of bondage. So there is a combination, without any friction, a synthesis of human effort and God's grace. So that is the place of guru, actually. Sa purvesham api guruhu. So the word guru is very important in the Vedantic tradition. Guru is one who is somebody who brings a light into a dark room, a semi-dark room, or who will switch on the electric switch so that there will be floodlight. Now suppose you have something in your room, you don't see it clearly, you need a light. But you have to see for yourself. If somebody brings a light in a dark room and you keep your eyes closed, you won't see that. So guru is one who removes, who drives away darkness. He doesn't reveal the truth, that's your job. But his role is limited to removing darkness. So the gushabdastha andhakarasya, rushabdastha nirodhaka, andhakara nirodhitvat guruhu iti abhidhiyade. This is this quoted by Yoga Sutra commentators. Gu implies somebody, gu is simply something dark, ignorance, so to speak, absence of light. And ru is somebody who removes that darkness. So Guru is one who doesn't bring light, but rather who only removes darkness. When darkness is gone, what is left? Only light. If there is somebody who removes darkness, it should be light only. So, that's a very important philosophy in common yoga and also in Vedanta. So this should be understood to understand this logical, I would say, how logical, this logical significance. You have to compare this with teachings of Martin Luther, who said, whatever you do, no, only God should give a gift, take this. So, liberation is God's gift. It is in no way related to what you do. And after some decades, Calvin came, he said, no, everything is predetermined. And so, everything is already written. You are damned and you are going to purgatory and somebody else is going to heaven. But Vedanta says, everyone, and yoga also, yoga outlines the path. The spiritual practices, yama, niyama, all these yoga. In fact, all these are accepted by Vedanta also. Remember, one interesting and very important thing to remember is the psychology of yoga is accepted by all other schools, theistic schools of Hindu philosophy. Vedanta, devotion philosophy, all these schools, they accept yama, niyama, all these qualities are necessary. That's where you begin of spiritual or inner journey. And then what happens? Slowly we reach a point when if somebody will switch on the light, we will see what it is. Because our eyes will be opened. First of all, we will realize that we are in a dark room. Then only if somebody brings light, you understand the importance of light. So the first point is to recognize the fact we are in a dark room, and this is certainly not a very wonderful, happy state of affairs. And then we understand. So that's the place of Ishvara as teacher in the yoga system. The next sutra is very, very important. That is Tasya Vachaka Pranavaha. So Pranava, is Omkara. So it is a very, very important sutra. It's very closely related to our spiritual practices. Now, one should not get away. The word which expresses him is pranava. His designation is pranava. All these are possible English translations. But translations can never do full justice to this. No, none of these translations into any of the Indian vernacular languages have ever done full justice to this subject. So, first of all, we should understand what is pranava. So, as an introduction, I would say, to communicate an idea, normally, we have to use pratikas, some kind of external symbols or signs. So that's what you use, There is always an inherent, invisible connection between the word and what that word implies. So, gradually, when we utter the word, that word will signify something and our mind immediately visualizes something which the real implication of that word. Now, this is called in Sanskrit pratika. Now, to give a very simple example, before taking up the topic, because this is something which all of us are familiar with. We go to temples, and Catholics go to Christian churches. You have seen wonderful, beautiful pictures of saints and Virgin Mary, Jesus Christ, and great saints and sages you find in the churches, in the cathedrals, and the Hindu temples, in Buddhist temples, and many of these in the Shinto, many of these temples you find a large number of images, pictures, statues, sometimes drawn photos, whatever it is. Or, to give a simple example, a fan of 49ers will have a photo of the 7 feet tall, 500 feet heavy man, his photo sitting on his table. So for him it is a symbol. It is a pratika. The person is different, but the picture and the person and what that picture implies, all these are interrelated. So this should be understood. The real person whose photo is remaining here and the photo or the picture, and what that picture implies to the person who has kept the picture. So for example, the photo of a saint, the real saint, and what that photo implies to the devotee of God, who looks upon that saint or the picture with a sense of sanctity and sacredness. So also in temples, the image of a god or goddess or Buddha, whoever may be, the real Buddha and its representation in the form of a statue or a photo, and what it implies to a sincere devotee who looks upon this picture or whatever it is with a sense of sacredness. All these are interrelated. So all these should be understood before we understand the meaning of pranava. So, as I mentioned, you know, when we try to explain something, communicate the knowledge, we use these pratikas. Omkara is the highest pratika. Why Omkara is called the word which expresses the infinite, the transcendental reality? You call it infinite, you call it indescribable, non-definable, and you say his name is Omkara. That's almost silly. So we should understand this very well. Okay, now, these pratikas are normally twofold. One, it could be in the form of signs or symbols. So signs are like, you know, this, like it's called bodhaga, something which indicates something else. See. And so they are called signs. It's called bodhaga. The other one is something which expresses vachaka. To a word you express something, it is called vachaka. And for example, traffic sign. It is bodhaga. You mean, it doesn't say anything, but the traffic sign gives you, it indicates whether the road is the right direction or not. So, for example, this, all these roads, signs, symbols, all these constitute, they're called indicative, rather they're called bodhaka. The other one is called vachaka. So actually walk means to speak. As I mentioned, you know, signs, bodhaka, with traffic signals, arrow mark, and all these are called different things. Now, there's a difference between bodhaka, which are signs or which indicate certain things, and symbols, vachaka, which actually do not directly tell you whether this direction or that direction, rather we directly implies something that you immediately understand. So, in Vedanta and in yoga, the word Omkara is composed of three important words. Three important, not words, other syllables. One is akara, ukara, makara. A, u, ma, together constitute Omkara. Now, Vedanta philosophers, especially those who wrote Mandukikarika commentaries, all of them, they try to explain this. Akara, the first A, it refers to whatever we understand, whatever we experience in waking state, or whatever we experience in dream state, and ma, whatever you experience in deep sleep state. There is nothing imaginable or conceivable that belong to any of these three categories. So whatever we communicate, whatever we live with, whatever we experience belong to these three levels of consciousness, that is waking state, dream state, and deep sleep state. In other words, Omkara is a subtle symbol of the whole existence, the whole reality. Whatever exists in the triple states of consciousness and the existence of awareness in all these three states, I mean waking state, dream state, and deep sleep state. Whatever we recognize, you understand, whatever we become conscious of, and whatever we experience with, all these are included in this particular symbol, Om. It is just being highly. I shall try to make it more clear by a very simple description of Swami Vivekananda. I shall read out that particular portion after some time. But before that, I want to make this point clear. So whatever we experience with, whatever we see and experience, whatever knowledge we can have, either empirical or transempirical, transcendental or empirical, phenomenal knowledge, all these are included in Omkara. Because it refers to the three levels of human consciousness, and also it refers to whatever we cognize in the three levels of human consciousness. Another important point, remember, in this context is this pranava omkara is often used as a spiritual practice. After this, I shall read Vivekananda's description. Very, very interesting description. This omkara is used as a spiritual practice. So when we utter this omkara, we have to remember there are three levels of our own spiritual experience, and there are three types of our own practice. One is called, this is called vachikam, verbal. You utter this omkara mantra, which is where it is visible. You yourself hear it. It is called vachika, verbal. The other one is the lips moving, but it is not visible, it is not audible directly. But, and the third is subtle, is mental, inward, inner way of chanting this Omkara mantra. So three levels, that is the grossest level is Vachika, and the most subtle, the most advanced state is when you are in deep communication with the essence of the Omkara, it becomes manasika, means it is subtle, it is mental. In between, it is not too verbal, but it has not reached the subtlest state. It is called upamsu, where the lips are moving, but at the same time, you are aware of your practice. These are three types of practices. Now, as a result of, to give a simple example, in all spiritual practices, in all traditions, there are three levels. You don't think this is confined to yoga. There are people who practice devotional music so violently, so that they themselves get disturbed and the listeners also get disturbed. It's so loud and almost to the point of creating so much of sound pollution. But there is one good point about it. Instead of doing something, so shouting something else, they are maybe chanting or singing some devotional poetry. You find this in all traditions. Very verbal, very physical way of practicing devotion. Very physical. Very violent. I remember long back, maybe 25 years back, I was watching I was waiting for train 20, 30 years back, and I found first distance about 50, 100 feet away, I could see people's hands coming up, and terrible sound also. So it was the Pentecost or evangelicals, Pentecost, Ceylon Pentecost people practicing devotion. So violent, so physical. And you find all in Hindu traditions also, very physical, very violent. But it's good, nothing wrong in it. After all, doing something else, instead of shouting something else, they are shouting God's name, something related to some religion or spirituality. That's certainly better than nothing else. But that is the grossest way of doing spiritual practice. So it is mentioned in the context of Omkara. In individual spiritual practice, you find loud way of chanting Omkara. In its gross manifestation, you find this violent musical, very physical, very violent demonstrative practices of devotion you find. The second stage, as I mentioned, more subtle, it is called Upamshu, where you find lips moving. You find in the way of a pilgrim, when the pilgrim learned the Jesus prayer and he continued walking all the way, you find he was practicing this. So this is very common in all, many traditions. You find people practice this. At the highest stage, where it is deeper, intense, subtle, and mental, at the psychological level, you communicate in a subtle way. You communicate with a particular holy name. It is called vachikam. It is verbal upamsu, where lips are moving. You don't hear sound. And other is the highest, it is called manasikam. Now, in parallel to this, there is another way of analyzing this spiritual practice. This also, we should not get away with the impression that this is limited to the practice of pranava, omkara alone. No. You find this everywhere, in all traditions. It is called parapashyanti madhyama vaikari. Parapashyanti madhyama, these are three levels which are somewhat advanced. Grossest level is vaikari. Vaikari means very loud, just like in a verbal. Very loud, where you hear your own voice, or you practice devotional music to hear your own voice. See, it is the grossest one. As you advance further, it's called madhyama. Madhyama is more advanced than vaikari, where you may hear, but you are not focusing on the sound vibrations coming from you. Rather, you go deeper. It is called madhyama. The third stage is pashyanti. Pashyanti means where it is more intense, deeper, more subtle. And it remains like manasika japa, like that, mental practice of omkara. At the highest stage is para, where you actually spiritually experience the essence of the holy name you are uttering. This is the natural state of a great mystic, the para state, where you realize, you communicate at the deepest inner level of your consciousness with the reality, the essence of what you are practicing. So there is no voice, no noise. It is the language of the language used in that level of spiritual practice is silence. Silence. All words practically merge when we reach the experience level. So in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, you find Sri Ramakrishna had a very funny way of explaining all this. Very simple way. I'm just giving this textual, theological, philosophical explanation. See, in Gospel you find Sri Ramakrishna says, suppose you are sitting for lunch, and if soup comes, of course Sri Ramakrishna uses different terms, I'm putting in the language of modern Western context. If soup comes, you may be talking about politics, you may be discussing the latest news that every day, of course. Very wonderful news are coming every day these days. So that's what you do. And as you start eating more and more important, delicious things, the sound comes down. And when the most delicious item comes, your total silence. Pious, that's what. Sri Ramakrishna gives the example, you know. Then people won't worry much about talking anything. They are not interested in anything else. They are interested only eating that. So when the highest experience comes, it is silence. So this is how Sri Ramakrishna analyzes these four levels of our own realization of the essence of our spiritual practices. Now I shall read a very interesting description by Swami Vivekananda about Omkara. That is a very well-known description. So Swamiji is referring to one of the Yoga Sutra commentators. The commentator says, the manifesting word of God is Om. So that tasivachaka pranavaha. That is the sutra. The name by which you call God is Om. And so we should remember, if you read only the translation, you would say, yeah, God has your name, it is Om. It doesn't mean that. It is something much deeper. So Swamiji says, why does he emphasize this word? There are hundreds of words for God. Remember, the word Om is not part of modern Sanskrit corpus or dictionary. You don't find it explained in dictionaries as a word which indicates, which implies a visible object. But it is that which implies or indicates everything that exists and all of our awareness or knowledge. So why does he emphasize this word? There are hundreds of words for God. One thought is connected with 1,000 words. The idea of God is connected with hundreds of words, and each one stands as a symbol for God. Very good. But there must be a generalization among all these words, some substratum, some common ground of all these symbols, and that which is the common symbol will be the best and will really represent them all. In making a sound, we use the larynx. So this Swamiji is explaining Omkara. In making a sound, we use the larynx and the palate as a sounding board. Is there any material sound of which all other sounds must be manifestations? One which is the most natural sound? In the Sanskrit grammatical commentaries, the grammarians explain Omkara like this. So grammarians say, for uttering the word syllable A, you have to open your mouth. For U, you have to close your mouth halfway. For Ma, you have to close the mouth completely. So actually all the words or syllables in all human languages belong to some kind of a manifestation of sounds coming from either from one of these three states of vocal cords. Open, half closed, and fully closed. A, open. Ma is fully closed. U, half closed. So that's how grammarians explain this. Swamiji had this in mind. So is there any one sound of which all other sounds should be manifestations, different manifestations? Om is such a sound, the basis of all sounds. The first letter, A, is the root sound, the key pronounced without touching any part of the tongue or palate. So open. U, remember in English it is written A, U, Yam it is written, but in Sanskrit A, U, Ma it is there. So ma represents yam in the English language, the last sound in the series being pronounced by the closed lips, completely closed ma. And u rolls from the very root to the end of the sounding board of the mouth. This om represents the whole phenomena of sound producing. So whatever we can think of, whatever we can speak and pronounce is included in om. So when I said this in an earlier session, somebody asked this question: what about certain things, the names of which we do not know? Still, when we see an object, the name of which we do not know, we will remember that object. Well, I saw something, but I don't know its name. That is our way of referring to that particular thing. If you see an animal in the zoo, and the first time you are seeing such an animal, and somebody asks you, what's the name of the animal? You say, well, I don't know the name of that animal. I don't know the name of the animal. That is, so far as you are concerned, the verbal representation of your experience of seeing something that you don't know the name of. I can say this is a paper, I know its name, but what about things that I don't know the name of? That also will have a representation, a verbal representation, in the form I don't know the name of it. In other words, every word has got something which that word implies. That's why, you know, in the famous drama of Kalidasa, it's called Kumara Sambhava. So his prayer begins like this: Vagartho yuva samrutto vagartha pradivatte jagata pidrau vante parvati parameshwar. It's an invocation for the grace of Shiva, Parvati, and Parameshwar, Lord Shiva. He says, Vak and Artha. Vak is word. Artha means what that word implies. They coexist. One cannot exist independent of the other. So, just like a word and what it implies exist together, similarly, Lord Shiva and Goddess Parvati exist together. Similarly, when people read my literary classic, let them immediately understand, get a real understanding of the meaning of the words which I am using in this famous book. It's a very famous drama of Kalidas called Kumara Sambhava, which is translated in 18th century for the first time. The early decades of 18th century, it was translated into German. So that's the importance of Tasyavachaka Pranavaka. There are different ways of interpreting the relationship between a word and what it implies in Indian philosophy. Mimamsaka has got one view, and Nayayikas, the logicians, have got another view. According to the Mimamsaka philosophers, you know, they say words have an inherent capacity, which they call yogyata, to mean certain things, and the relation between the two is eternal. That's what. Every word has an eternal, inherent relationship with what it implies. Another school, Nayayikas, they say this relation is artificial. So that will take you to another realm of polemics and dialectics, which I don't want to do. So now the pranava I used, you know, pranava is disunderstood. Pranava means tasyavachaka pranava. Pranava means omkara. It derived from the root nu, and is another prefix called ap and pra. Prakarsena nuyete stuyete iti. Something which eulogizes, which implies, which extols the highest reality. So that's about the 27th verse. Now we'll go to 28th verse. Tadjabastadartha bhavanam. That's the next verse. Tadjabastadartha bhavanam. So that jaba, that taking that holy name, taking the holy name and meditation on what that holy name refers to, on is referent. This should be done properly. That's the meaning of this verse. So, when we practice this Omkara, we should understand its true meaning. In fact, the effect of repetition of a holy name is more or less dependent upon our understanding of the meaning of that name. So, if we can repeat a holy word, a holy phrase, or a holy hymn, or psalm, or any religious tradition, with the full awareness of what that hymn, that word symbol implies, then the effect is faster and more intensive. Somebody may ask this question. So, many of us, many people, many devotees I know, they repeat the sacred psalms of stotras, we call, you know, sacred hymns, Sanskrit hymns or Latin, traditional Catholics, or maybe Hebrew, all day too. Without understanding meaning, we should not utter, we should not get away with that impression. Elsewhere, there are two sutras in the Yoga Sutra itself. It says, even if you do not fully understand the meaning of a sacred hymn, if you have a sense of complete recognition, and if you utter that sacred name, or japa, do japa, with absolute complete sraddha. Sraddha means a sense of sanctity, sacredness, intensity, earnestness. Then that will compensate for the lack of your understanding of the meaning. So that is a very important point, remember. Here also you can refer to Sri Ramakrishna. He clears all this ground instead of going to polemics and dialectics. Sri Ramakrishna says, suppose a little baby, the baby is not pronouncing the mother, putting the right stress, the right syllable, you know, putting the RP, nothing of the kind. The baby may make some noise. Mother won't be angry. You are not pronouncing my name properly. Mother won't be angry. Because mother knows the baby is referring, calling her name. So if devotees use hymns, chant hymns, sacred names, without proper understanding of the philosophical dimension of what they are repeating, it doesn't matter. That problem will be solved by proper sraddha. And sraddha here means a sense of sanctity, sacredness, intensity, earnestness with which we do a spiritual practice. That will compensate for all other, for the absence of grammatical accuracy or anything like that. So that's Sri Ramakrishna uses very, very simple language. He asked, but when devotee asked him about this, he said, if a child or a baby calls his mother, the mother won't judge the baby's call on the basis of the grammatical accuracy or the phonetic accuracy. No. Phonetics and grammar do not play an important role there. She will immediately knows that the child is calling her and she will come to her. That's how Sri Ramakrishna solves the problem. So now we will have interaction. And before interaction, I want to make this announcement. There will be no Yoga Sutra class next Friday. So the next class will be 2 weeks from today, on Friday, February the 23rd. Because on 17th February, on Saturday, we have the public celebration and puja of Sri Ramakrishna's birthday celebration here. All of you are welcome. That is 17th February, Saturday. Because we'll be busy making preparations for that, there'll be no class on Friday, the 16th February. So the next class will be Friday, February the 23rd. Thank you. So you can ask questions.
Yes, I have something I kind of thought the other day, is that prayer without reflection not followed by action is an empty deed. And you're saying to have the prayer will solve the problem if they believe it. I don't know. I mean, because I've yet to meet a Christian who loves his enemy, even though that's all they talk about. So,
can you explain once more?
Okay, well, I see people pray all the time, and I don't see their behavior really change that much.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, so I, like, you know, Jesus said, love your enemy. I've yet to meet a Christian who loves his enemy. So, and that's, I mean, I really admire what Jesus said and did. I just don't think it's practiced that well. Even when I go to Mass with my wife, because she's Catholic, the priest last time seemed quite egotistical and supposedly he knows the scriptures. You know, he was talking down to us. So I don't necessarily understand how, if as long as you say the hymn, it leads to salvation. If that's what you were saying, I don't know. I could be understanding, misunderstanding.
Yes. So perhaps, in example, we can try to pray sincerely. For pray, doing our prayer, we need not necessarily go to a place of worship. The best prayers are always done in solitary, when we are in a solitude. True prayer is opening our heart according to great theologians like Augustine, you know, who wrote elaborately on confessions prayer. So opening our heart in solitude. That's a sincere prayer can really happen only in solitude. This is fine. There's a very, very important point. Remember, sincere prayer, even from a psychological point of view, sincere prayer can happen only in solitude. We can communicate with our heart, we can communicate with God only in solitude. So when we do that, then we need not worry about this, you know, this lack of practice, lack of, I mean, people preach but they don't practice. We need not worry about it. So we can do our own prayer. That's the best answer.
Resort to violence instead of peace.
Yes, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's the misinterpretation of the scriptures is kind of what I took it as. So.
I would rather leave the responsibility to them.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Because frequently when we, you find every religion there are great men and women who are eager to go to the real meaning, the root of the teachings of their traditional religious teachings. There are many among all different traditions and denominations who understand the inadequacy of public demonstrations of piety and institutional practices. But that's why spiritual practice is essentially an individual affair. We should learn all this, but it is a matter of our own inner spiritual journey. Frequently, religion is hijacked by organizations and institutions. So, institutionalization creates this problem. The good point is, if you read the autobiographical writings of great Christian saints, if you read the Vedantic books, you find there is parallel to this institutional hierarchical religions, there's another stream where great saints and sages and teachers, they lived differently and they taught differently. So that's what we should consider to be our source of inspiration and guidance. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm wondering about the liberation that you speak of.
Yeah.
What is that liberation for? Is that liberation an end in itself, or is when liberation is attained that it's meant to exalt our lives or to be applied in some other way? That's my first question.
This next question I may not remember. So this question I shall answer first. Yeah, this liberation is its own end. Now, how do we feel? What's the experience aspect of liberation we call? We feel a kind of inner contentment. It is not contentment in the sense it is a satisfaction that we feel when we get something or when we do not get something, not that way. A kind of inner fulfillment, inner completeness. So it is a matter of inner experience. This is true in liberation, in Nirvana, in Buddhist tradition, in Vedantic tradition, and so in the teachings of the mystics you find. It's a matter of inner experience. A theoretical analysis of what it is should be undertaken after realizing the fact that it cannot really be intellectually understood. It cannot be explained. So we can only feel it happening in our life. Even when we practice yama, niyama, all these fundamental disciplines mentioned in the early part, the samadhipada, you know, you find kind of inner contentment. So when we reach that level of liberation, we feel a kind of inner joy.
So what I'm not hearing is that, is it possible the liberation in itself has another higher purpose? That realization means something?
Realization is its own goal. It doesn't have any purpose as such. Once we reach that level of spiritual awareness, then Vedanta texts tell you, people may continue doing the work they are doing, but they won't be attached to the work or its results. They'll be doing for the good of others. So there is a kind of change of priorities, you know. And the way we look upon life and work and its obligations, all these undergo radical change. So fundamentally we should know that it actually manifests in the form of a kind of inner contentment. That's what it
is. So how one would live or how one would live with liberation in itself is self-evident, or is it, what is that process?
Well, when we realize that we have a spiritual dimension.
If we have that sense of realization, that sense of transcendence, is it self-evident as to what
is done? It is self-evident.
Or is it differently manifested from person to person?
Yeah. We feel it's that experience within ourselves. We don't look for a proof. It is something that we experience. And when somebody asked Sri Ramakrishna about this, he said, you know, even the sweetness of milk or candy, we cannot really explain. We can only experience. That's what Sri Ramakrishna said.
So, my last question. If we're fortunate enough to attain that state, would we expect that state would be a consistent, unwavering state, or is that required?
It would be consistent.
To sustain it.
It would be consistent. Well, you know how it happens. Again, to make it very simple, I can again give an example from Sri Ramakrishna's story. Actually, it is not a new knowledge that we get. It is not a new information, something that we attain, we make. It is actually a kind of self-discovery. We self-discover our true nature. The example that is given in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna is, you know, a lion cub, child lion, it got separated from its parents, its other the lion herds, and it grew up, a little baby, grew up with goats or deer, some other smaller animals, and it thought it was a goat or a deer, and it happened to see a huge real lion after it grew up, He ran away, thinking of itself as a sheep, as a goat or sheep or something. When the bigger lion, the attacking lion, caught hold of it and brought it and showed its face, its reflection on the water, brought that animal to a well or a lake and made it see its own face reflected on the water. Then suddenly it realized that there is no difference between the lion that is holding it and itself. So he understood it is the real lion. So the story is very simple. I mean, it is a kind of self-discovery. That's why it said it is a kind of self-discovery. But to discover our own true nature, we need some efforts on our own part and need some help from others. The help may come in different forms. We should make our own effort. So any kind of contentment, inner discontentment, dissatisfaction is an opening door to this higher journey. And Vedanta says, if you start this journey right now, you won't be lost. You will continue your journey even in the next life, even if you are not able to realize this. And there's a dialogue in the Bhagavad Gita between Krishna and Arjuna. So Arjuna asks one question, very simple question. See, you taught me all these meditation, karma yoga, all these. But what happens, suppose I don't realize anything, my life becomes a failure. And if I die before I realize this liberation, what is going to happen to me? Everything will be lost. Then Krishna tells him that nothing will be lost. What he uses is the word, nahi kalyanakrit kaschi durgatim tata gacchati. So whatever little effort you make, it will not go waste. You are never late and nothing is lost. And then at the end of the dialogue, Krishna makes a very interesting statement. He says, on the strength of whatever spiritual practices you have done in this life, which could be in the form of meditation, prayer, listening to ideas, reading scriptures, doing good work, whatever. That will produce a kind of, bank balance of karma phalas, karma and its results. Good vrittis, good samskaras, good impressions with which we are born is the checkbook with which we can draw on the capital we accumulated in previous life. So spiritual capital can be built up through good actions, good practices. Now this is it's a real thing. Frequently, I know it may, of course, religious traditions which believe only in one life cannot and will not accept this. How do you explain the plurality, the diversity of human temperaments? Some people take a great interest in certain higher values, though they are born in a totally different culture, brought up in an entirely different world, without any opportunity to connect with these ideas. When they happen to connect, you may go to the library and read a book, and that brings about a change in your life. It doesn't happen to everyone. It shows that person, as he's born, and he has brought with him spiritual capital that he built up in previous life. Good actions, good samskaras, good impressions, good vrittis, what we call vrittis. So, that will not be lost. Tatratam buddhisam yogam labhade pavrodehigam yadadecha tato bhoya samsiddho kurunantan. It's a famous verse in the 6th chapter of Gita. What it says, such a person is born. Then what happens? His intellect, his mind, he is full of some good samskaras, good vrittis, good impressions. With that, he establishes a connection with appropriate sources. If a person is born with good vrittis, good samskaras, good things, naturally, he will be looking to reconnect, looking for an opportunity to reconnect with what samskaras which he already received. That's why we feel a kind of inexplicable, indescribable feeling at home with certain things, certain ideas. So we cannot explain this in the light of heredity or environmental growing up or anything. And the Krishna says, you are helpless. So persons who had done a lot of spiritual practices in the previous life, and accumulated a lot of spiritual capital. Even if you want to become a wicked person, you cannot. Karedehi avashyak karma means you have no freedom. You are helpless. You will be pushed forward by your own good karmas, good vasanas, good samskaras in that direction. So this is an approach in Vedanta. Of course, this is understood in yoga system also. All these ideas, law of karma and reincarnation, rebirth, are accepted in all these traditions. So that's why when we talk about liberation, we should remember we are not talking about just one life, one opportunity. It's not like you should get a number of opportunities. Then only you could be selected for an Olympic team. Only one jump you run, if you fail, gone once for all. No. You can practice. You can improve your performance. So that's a very, very unique promise that you get in the Gita. You are not, whatever little you good things you do, you accumulate a good bank balance. So you say you have no reason to feel anything is lost or that you are too late now. That's a very unique message of Gita. Okay, we'll continue the discussion in the next session. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Panamastu.